From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President-elect Joe Biden declared victory on Saturday night in front of a massive drive-in rally in Delaware after news outlets finally tallied Electoral College votes from Pennsylvania. Biden spoke triumphantly of the mandate that millions of voters handed him and his running mate Kamala Harris, and he promised to be a president for all Americans, not just Democrats. He also specifically raised several issues that need immediate work.
Campaign is over. What is the will of the people? What is our mandate? I believe it's this. Americans have called upon us to marshal the forces of decency, the forces of fairness, to marshal the forces of science and the forces of hope in the great battles of our time. The battle to control the virus, the battle to build prosperity, the battle to secure your family's health care, the battle to achieve racial justice and root out systemic racism in this country. And the battle to save our planet by getting climate under control. The battle to restore decency, defend democracy, and give everybody in this country a fair shot. That's all they're asking for, a fair shot.
That's President-elect Joe Biden speaking on Saturday. Biden will be walking a delicate tightrope in the coming weeks and months as he faces pressure from both the conservative and progressive wings of his party on how far he must go to undo Trump's damage to the nation. My guest is Bill Fletcher Jr., racial justice, labor, and international activist. He is also the executive editor of GlobalAfricanWorker.com and former president of Trans Africa Forum, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com. He's the author of a number of books, including They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, Reimagining Labor Unions, Busting Myths, Building Movements, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. Welcome to the program, Bill.
And Ali, great to be on the program.
So, first of all, I think many progressives are taking a moment to congratulate themselves, to celebrate this moment on Saturday, because it was the result of a about 6-month-long alliance with liberals to defeat Trump. And that is something that can't be overstated, right?
No, that's absolutely correct. There was a sign that someone hand-wrote that I love that said, end of an era, E-R-R-O-R. And I think that really summarized the way many of us felt in our guts, even though we realize that it's not the end of an era.
So we have this interesting moment now where Joe Biden has won the most votes of any presidential candidate in history, at the same time that Donald Trump garnered more votes than he did in 2016. Of course, we've had record turnout in this election, but the nation remains deeply divided. I mentioned to my colleagues that this is sort of glass half empty and glass half full situation. The glass half empty situation is that 70 million plus Americans still voted to keep a neo-fascist in office. The glass half full is that there were tremendous victories and inroads, huge turnout, especially by communities of color, especially by Black voters in key states, and just a massive mandate for Biden, who won even more votes than Obama did. So how do we view this? What happened this election?
Well, I think we start by first getting away from this whole narrative about how we're a divided country, because the reality, Sonali, is that we've always been divided. The United States has always been divided. Remember, we had a civil war. And you have to start there, because there's this imaginary situation that once upon a time we were all united, or most of us were, we were going in the same direction, and then something happened, and everything has fallen apart. No, Biden won the election. Now, I repeat it. Biden won the election. He could have won by one vote. It doesn't matter. He won. And I think we have to start there, right? And then the second thing is that this was an election where, you're right, 70 million people voted to reject reality. And I think that that's really important for us to also embrace and appreciate that 70 million people voted for someone who completely denies science, denies the COVID pandemic, denies climate change, and it was okay with them. They voted to accept and support, or at minimum tolerate, a racist, xenophobe, sexist. This is what we're dealing with. There is a mass base out there, which many people on the left have been in absolute denial about for years, refusing to accept that there's a mass right-wing populist movement in this country that actively wants to overthrow the 20th century. And that's what we're up against. But the good news is we've got the majority. And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that there were a whole lot of people that didn't vote that we have to figure out a way to inspire and win over.
Right. So there was massive turnout, but there were still lots of people who didn't vote. And that's something that gets lost in it, because the comparison, the massive voter turnout was relative to poor turnout that we've had in previous elections.
That's right. Precisely. And just one more historical point. In the U.S. War of Independence, which has, of course, been mythologized, the breakdown of the population, the colonial population, was roughly one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third supported independence, one-third supported the British, and one-third were in the middle. So we've developed this myth, again, of U.S. history, where you would think in the War of Independence that everybody and their grandmother was in favor of independence. That simply wasn't the case. And so what we have to deal with as progressive forces is, how do we shift the balance further? How do we create a new majority? That's our task.
And just a quick aside, is that 70 million number that voted for Trump also a testament to the power of propaganda? He made deep inroads, deeper than we expected, inroads into the Latino community and even into the Black community, because he spent 4 years telling the Latino and Black community that he's been the best president for them than any other president, perhaps, you know, especially for the Black community since Abraham Lincoln. And I suppose when you say that relentlessly, there will always be a small number of people that believe the hype, that believe the propaganda, whether it's rooted in reality or not.
I think that that's true. But I have to say, Sonali, I'm suspicious of how deep his expansion was. Definitely suspicious about how deep his expansion was among African Americans. But also among Latinos, it was basically two-thirds of Latinos and Latinas that voted against him. And I think that one of the things, this points a few things about the election. One is that Latinos and Latinas are not a voting bloc. They are a multiplicity. They are different ethnicities. They're not one grouping. And I think one of the mistakes that has been made in the media, certainly, is to look at Latinos as essentially equivalent to African Americans. It's just simply different. Another piece of this is that there's something that I've come to call progressive demographic politics. And it's a way that I think we incorrectly look at politics at the level of demography as opposed to social movements. You're going to always have, even within racially and nationally oppressed populations, people that will side with the oppressor. Franz Fanon was very clear about this when he talked about the colonial mentality. You'll have it, even within Black America, within segments of among the Latino population. I mean, how else can you explain that after 4 years of Latinos and Latinas being demonized by Trump, ridiculed, humiliated, that some would still vote? And it's obviously because they don't believe that they're his target. And so I think that we have to unpack the political situation a little bit more.
Right. Within Latinos, there is very heterogeneous racial breakdown, national breakdown, the topic for a whole nother conversation. So one of the things that I want to discuss is who Biden represents. In many ways, he is, I suppose, optimistically looking at it, an amalgam between the old Democratic Party and the new Democratic Party. He's the physical representation of the old Democratic Party, but his choice of running mate and the platform that he ran on is reflective in large part of the new Democratic Party. And the question now that faces him and the nation is which force he is going to succumb to or respond to or react to, because already, even before he was called president, there were pundits in the media and the mainstream corporate liberal media that were essentially threatening him that he would lose everything if he didn't go down the conservative path and embrace the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, right?
That's correct. So let's start with some things that he did right. In picking Kamala Harris, picking a woman, then picking a woman who is African-American and South Asian, symbolically, this was amazing. And so I think that was very critical. Second is that the Democratic Party platform was far more progressive than it had been in the past. And even what Biden would talk about was to the left of probably what he expected to be talking about. So when you say, who does he represent? I think you summed it up correctly. I think it is a broad front of anti-Trump forces, because that includes those Republicans and conservative Democrats that were prepared to go with him. It includes the centrist Democrats. And that includes progressive and left forces. And it includes wide swaths of Black America and Latino America. It includes wide swaths of Asian America. So one of the things that I wish that Biden had said on Saturday was in response to Trump's argument that the Republicans are the party of the US worker, which is absurd. I think that Biden should have been very clear that the party of the US worker, in terms of the party that has workers at their base, really is a Democratic Party. And the party that is more diverse or most diverse is the Democratic Party. Now, the politics of the Democratic Party are the source of the battle that we're talking about here. And I think that much like we saw happen when Obama was elected in 2008, immediately there were forces on the right wing of the Democratic Party that jumped in to push him in a way that I'm starting to see again, which is to basically be the person, the compromiser, the great compromiser, to be the adult in the room, to extend his hand. Now, rhetorically, if he wants to extend his hand, that's fine. But he has to be clear in a way that Obama was not, that the Republicans were out, they're out to cut his knees off. You know, cut him off at the knees, I should say. And that's what Obama missed in 2008, 2009.
Yeah, they love to give Republicans the benefit of the doubt.
Always. That's right. Always. And when you look in contrast, when Republicans come in, they never stick out their hands, but at least in the recent era, in the issue of so-called bipartisanship, they move swiftly. They move a blitzkrieg. So I think what we have to learn is that there is no time for us as progressives, which is one of the reasons that I loved AOC's comments. There's no time for us to basically sit back and say, all right, let's give Biden Harris, you know, some breathing room. No, there is no breathing room. We need to be pushing from the left and pushing really hard.
Let's talk about what AOC said. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman congresswoman from New York who easily won re-election along with other members of the so-called squad, progressive young women of color. She was interviewed by the New York Times, and what her analysis was, because of course the Democrats have looked back on this race and said, all right, we won the presidency, but we lost seats in the House. They were actually expecting to expand their House majority. They were hoping to control the Senate. They don't have control of the Senate, and they may get marginal control if they win, and that's a big if, two Senate races in Georgia in January. They didn't flip a single state House across the nation. Republicans maintain their control of state legislative bodies. And her analysis to the New York Times was that one was that the party is very old-fashioned in how it does its campaigning. They have not made inroads into the digital realm like the Republicans have or that Obama did. But she also, I think more importantly, suggests that by trying to play to the center, those candidates who played to the center lost their races, and those candidates who spoke about issues important to Americans from the left won their races. There's a huge fight already in the Democratic Party about that because the moderates, like Connor Lamb, who was also interviewed by the New York Times, are blaming AOC and the progressives for his narrow win and for the loss of seats by other moderates. So where do you stand on this?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be very careful about what conclusions we draw for a little while because this right. was a very unusual election. And one of the things that made it unusual was the pandemic. And the pandemic derailed the organizing strategy of the Democrats. And it meant that for months, instead of door-to-door organizing, community organizing, et cetera, it was virtual. The Republicans, on the other hand, in large part because of their pandemic denial, did more of the on-the-ground work. The Democrats eventually started catching up. There were groups like the Union Unite Here that did a marvelous job in terms of mobilization. But because of that, Sonali, I think we have to be careful about conclusions. Second is that I think that the Congresswoman is absolutely correct and historically is correct that when the Democrats particularly at the local races, essentially tack to the right and move in a more conservative direction, move their campaigns based on the idea of either being good managers and or simply as opponents of the Republican incumbent, they don't do so well. And it's those that inspire that do well. Now, that raises to me an interesting question about the national election, because if what I just said is correct, why did Biden win?
Right. Why did Biden win the primary race? Why did Bernie Sanders not do better twice now?
Right. And I think because there's something different at stake at the national presidential level than at local levels. What it appears now, and again, all of this has to be tentative, is that there were many people that voted for Biden but voted Republican down ticket. And part of this is this U.S. idea of dividing government, not giving one branch of government too much. But I think the other part of it was that there were a lot of people that simply were sick of Trump and I think very much influenced by the pandemic, and wanted him out regardless of anything else. Now, Biden won the primary, I think in part because he had a much more solid base among African Americans than Bernie Sanders did. And I think that he was able to convince others who were, like Buttigieg and others, that he would have a much better chance of taking on Trump than any of them.
And Jim Clyburn being a sort of kingmaker.
Yeah. So I think we have to, that's why I'm saying, I think we have to look at these election results more carefully. And I go with AOC, absolutely. I think that first of all, keep in mind, and something implicit in what she was saying, is that a number of the seats that got flipped had been weak seats. I don't mean that the individuals were weak. That's not my point. It's not a personal criticism. It was that these were areas that were very uneven. Now, you know, the Democrats were hoping to flip Texas. I think Texas is going to be flipped within the next 4 years. I was hoping this year it would. I think that there's a number of shifts that are going on in Texas, but I think that what this calls upon is a different kind of movement building and organization building. And this takes us in part back to the issue of Latinos and Latinas, that the Democratic Party did a terrible job in reaching out to the Latino-Latina base. And that as opposed to Trump, who definitely made a strategic decision to focus on, at least in Florida, Latinos and Latinas, and particularly the emigre population that was running away from the pink tide in Latin America, the Democratic Party made no such investment. The Democratic Party needs to immediately develop a well-funded, well-led Latino-Latino organizing project, and it needs to be a permanent feature of the organization.
Bill, going forward for Biden's task before him, and he's moving quite swiftly, which is really good. He's taking action first and foremost on the COVID-19 pandemic, which also seems the reasonable and sensible thing to do. But I'm wondering what you think about how he would move ahead without major Democratic control of the Senate. I mean, because Trump mm-hmm. made so many changes via executive order, in some ways, isn't it easier for Biden to undo those changes via his executive orders? And then, you know, if and when the Democrats do take the Senate, perhaps in 2022, although that's not necessarily likely, maybe build something permanent. And so the question is, one, can he undo Trump's legacy easily? And two, in doing so, does he jeopardize Democrats retaining control of the important houses of government?
No. I think and it really sounds like the president-elect is thinking along these lines of reversing these ridiculous executive orders. And I think that that's fantastic. I think that people have to see action, Sonali, and they have to see audacity. This is a moment for audacity. Mm. And he needs to reverse these ridiculous executive orders. We need to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. Rebuild the relations with Iran, with the nuclear deal, et cetera. I would say that Biden needs to be the president of the Green New Deal. He needs to be the president of a different foreign relations. And so for progressives, we need to make sure that the Biden administration does not or steps away from policies of previous administrations, including one that he was a part of interference in Latin America. The U.S. needs to step away from being the ATM for Israel and instead needs to be stepping back. And frankly, I think stepping away from its engagement in the Middle East because it cannot be trusted to be the honest broker there. And I think that there's a series of other steps that must be taken immediately by this administration that do not depend on a Democratic majority in Congress. I think that he can do that. But the whole issue of being the president of the Green New Deal, this in some ways, Sonali, is my thinking about the platform going forward, the platform going into the midterm elections, going into 2024, that we need jobs, we need to rebuild the economy, but we need to build it in a way that is saving this planet. And I think that there's really no room to equivocate on that.
Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have you on.
It's a pleasure being on. Thank you very much. It's an honor.
My guest has been Bill Fletcher, Jr., racial justice, labor and international activist and executive editor of globalafricanworker.com, former president of TransAfrica Forum, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and editorial board member of blackcommentator.com. We've been discussing whether Biden can undo Trump's disastrous legacy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.